afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and I'm here with my co-host, Dave Allen, as we bring you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events. And today is Thursday, July 15th, 2021. Good afternoon, Dave.
Hey there, Melody.
Hey, let's see what gold and silver is doing today. If my computer is not frozen, and it's not, gold is $1,830. $1,830, up $1.70. Silver, $26.40, up 7 cents. Platinum was up $11 at $1,143. Palladium was down 100 bucks at $2,816. The USDX today was up 0.24, 92.60. Crude oil was down another buck and a half at 71.60. Paper markets today, a mixture here. The Dow was up 54 points, 34,988. S&P was down 14 at 43.60. NASDAQ was down 101, 14,543. Europe, overnight, they were all negative. The DAX was down 159 points, just 1%. Most of them across the board were down 1%, maybe a little over. The Nikkei was down over 1%. Shanghai and the Hang Seng were all positive. So a little bit of a mixture there. Bonds today on the 10-year yield, that dipped back down to 1.299%. So 1.299%. on the 10-year yield. So kind of interesting there as we see more talk and discussions about inflation and the numbers and certainly Powell being on the Hill today about inflation. And I don't know why in the heck they would ask him about climate change. I mean, are you kidding me? Really? The Federal Reserve Chairman, they ask him about climate change. Get real. And another one interesting notation is we're going to talk about this big investor, Gundlach, says the dollar is doomed. So we're going to be talking about that here in just a little bit. But we all know it is Thursday, and what comes every Thursday? It's the new jobless claims. And, of course, we all expected that to the unemployment insurance fell. This was reported today by the Labor Department. First-time filings for benefits totaled 360,000. That's kind of in line of the economist's estimates. Total represented roughly a 7% decrease from the previous week's upwardly revised. Interesting. Upwardly revised. 386,000. Continuing claims, that runs a week behind. The headline number fell by 4%, and that also sets a new low for a jobs market that still has some distance to go before getting back to where we were before the pandemic. And let's see. I don't know what else is kind of interesting there to the pull out of that. Labor participation is down 2.7% since 2020. The total number of workers counted as unemployed is over 3.7 million higher. So that's anything else you'd like to say about that, Dave?
Nope. I think you said what needs to be said this week. In a separate economic report, Melody, out this morning, it showed that manufacturing and hiring are booming in the benchmark New York State region. The Empire State Manufacturing Survey, conducted by the New York Fed, rose to a record 43 for July. That represents the percentage difference between firms seeing expansion versus those seeing contraction. Now, new orders and shipments surged, while the employment index increased 8.3 points to 20.6, as almost 30% of companies indicated they would be adding workers. Now, a forward-looking index on conditions over the next 6 months, that also showed a hiring increase with a reading of just about 44, which is up 2 points from June. Now, the news comes a day after the Fed's Beige Book release on economic conditions across the country. That report showed moderate to robust growth, their words, not ours, nationally, while the New York region reported an economy growing at a strong pace, again, their words, as business contacts were increasingly optimistic about the near-term outlook. Now, while New York reported a burst in growth, the New York region said today, the Philadelphia region, excuse me, said today that progress there is slowing. That area's manufacturing reading slipped to a little shy of 22 in July, all the way from 30.7 in June, though the headline number still indicated expansion. Both reports also indicated some deceleration in the rate of price increases amid otherwise high inflation readings. Again, raising doubt in the mainstreamers, the Wall Streeters, that this inflation is just temporary and nothing to be concerned about in the long run.
Well, I think we'll talk about it a little bit later in the program, but I think Powell came out and said, yeah, inflation is going to be here longer than,
Yes.
Then what? What it was D.C. was saying, Washington was saying that inflation is going to be here longer than what Powell is saying, or something like that. But one of them, right?
Council of Economic Advisors. Yeah, the White House.
The White House. Yeah.
White House guys.
Gee, who do you believe? Oh, what a crazy world! And you know, here's just another sign. You have old cars now. It doesn't matter how much mileage you have. Old cars are in demand. Supply chain issues in the auto market unexpectedly fueled an explosion of demand for used cars. The value of used cars surged by so much that now it's distorting the national measures of inflation. And, you know, we've been talking a lot about inflation recently. And one of the stories we discussed on Tuesday's program was how the rising prices of used cars and trucks are driving the inflation numbers 45% year over year in June. So while the most popular vehicles in the wholesale used car market consist of lightly driven 2018 models, Edmunds found that even older ones with a whole lot more mileage are in high demand. And the average sale price of a used car with 100,000 miles rose to almost 17,000 in June, and that's up 31%, which was barely higher than June's 2019 average price of $12,528. So, Dave.
Well, and interestingly, it took about a month, 30.5 days to sell these vehicles on average during the month, down from just about 38 days a year ago. Now, Ford F-150s, pickup truck with an average age of 7 years plus, are selling for just about $26,000. That's up from $18,000 a year ago. That's a pretty big jump. Edmunds' Ivan Drury said, we're seeing 7 to 8 year old vehicles with more than 100,000 miles commanding prices today that are more like the cost of 5 year old vehicles with 60 to 80,000 miles just a year ago. He added that the average price of these, quote, clunkers had moved sideways for years before the current frenzy for used cars took off. Now, bottom line, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a car sitting in your garage or driveway that you've been putting off selling, well, now might just be the time to put it on the market.
Well, I suspect. But, you know, what they're going to have to do is cars do last a little bit longer. I mean, most of your vehicles do have, 200,000, 250, don't you think most of them, people know they can drive them for a lot longer, so they hold on to them for a little bit longer than they used to?
They might, but I don't think they're holding on to them for 200 and 250,000. I mean, they might when they start looking at these prices, if they're looking to trade theirs in. But no, I mean, clearly you make the good point that it's always been like that. And largely, kudos, I guess, to the big automakers of the world, you know, who've been successful over the years at, you know, advertising to get folks to buy new and trade in your cars before their time.
Actually, it always seemed that it was foreign cars, your Toyotas, your Nissans, that was one of their advertising, that you could drive to 200, 250,000 miles on them. I don't think the American cars ever made those levels that as much. But anyway, so, you know what, and it's amazing, why not? Why shouldn't they make, you know, it's, anyway, change your oil,
planned obsolescence.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah, change your oil.
Change your oil.
here.
We've been talking, I think we've also mentioned about falling rents. You know, we have all this excess of empty space, restaurants that are already outfitted with kitchen appliances. And so there's a chance that some folks might take advantage of these historically low rates. And it's kind of driving restaurateurs to sign fresh leases across the New York City area. Food and beverage tenants were the most active in signing retail deals across Manhattan during the second quarter. Some, like Flex Muscles, they're staging a comeback after last year's indoor dining restrictions, you know, just totally decimated the industry. Now, this seafood establishment is just moving one block over from its pre-pandemic home on the Upper East Side to take over a roughly 4,500 square foot two-story space that was vacated by a Turkish restaurant in 2020. So, you know, and it's going to, you know, and you know what, this is, might distort numbers, Dave, because it'll show that you have a new business because they're moving and they're staging a comeback, but you still had a Turkish restaurant that went out of business. So, you know, you just have to keep, you know, when they're saying everybody's, you know, all these restaurants are opening up and this and that, just remember, a lot still closed that aren't opening up. Industry Tracker Data Essential found that more than a tenth of U.S. restaurants, 80,000 locations, of about 779,000 eateries have closed permanently since 2020. Other businesses view the carnage as an opportunity to enter the market for the first time, almost to the same as the foreclosure crisis during the Great Recession. So you have Mezza Mediterranean Grill in Annapolis, Maryland-based chain serving Greek-inspired dishes. Just signed their first lease in Manhattan, Dave.
Nice. Well, you got all kinds of restaurants signing. And these leases are long-term in many cases. The Casa del Mofongo, a Latin restaurant, nightclub, signed a 10-year deal in 15,000 square foot space close to Herald Square. The salad chain Sweet Green and Shake Shack also announced new outposts, with the latter planning to open as many as 40 new restaurants this year. All across Manhattan, restaurant chains signed 23 deals during the second quarter that encompasses over 83,000 square feet. Apparel businesses were the second most active group, with 10 leases totaling 49,000 square feet. That's somewhat surprising in and of itself. In any event, they were followed by healthcare operators and jewelers. So leasing velocity has now decelerated for 8 consecutive quarters. It's according to CBRE's tracking of 16 major retail corridors in Manhattan. Retail rents fell about 11%. 615 per square foot, still an extraordinarily high rent compared to what you see on Main Street most places. CBRE noted that the current rent rates are the lowest levels in nearly a decade.
Treasury yields, we've talked about coming onto the program today, falling once again. And, of course, this is following a dovish message on monetary policy from Jerome Powell yesterday to members of Congress. We saw the 10-year Treasury note fall 3 more basis points. Yields we've seen have been falling since March, the last time the 10-year was above 1.7%. But what Powell told the House Financial Services Committee yesterday was that the economy is a ways off from where it needs to be for us to tighten its easy monetary policy. I think that's kind of what we've been saying here. There's no way he can do it. It's going to be a ways off. I don't know why everybody was trying to suggest that it's going to be sooner than later. It's not going to happen. But he engaged in a little more Fed speak before the Senate Committee on Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs today. Auctions are being held today for $40 billion of 30-day bills and $35 billion of 60-day bills. Last week, the yield slipped as low as 1.25%, slumping to the lowest level since February. But there's some analysts out there, Dave, that are saying that falling yields mean that the bond market views inflation as, what's the word of the year? Transitory. Just as the Fed has been saying. And what say you, Dave?
Well, you know, I say we all have to get on the same page, Melody, or else the American public's going to continue to be flummoxed by all this misinformation and mixed signals. Yes, we are seeing yields in the U.S. and around the developed world fall, but what that means in terms of inflation is, I believe, is still anyone's guess. Although some like Ron Insana, I call him Ron Insana, at CNBC, believes it means that inflation has peaked. Ah! And the rate of economic growth has also peaked at home and abroad as well. Insana says all this means that investors of all stripes, foreign and domestic, are offsetting their exposure to global equities by purchasing high-quality treasuries to provide balance in their portfolios. Once again, all the mainstreamers ignore the precious metal investors. Moreover, Melody warns that the spread of the COVID Delta variant may further slow global growth if it continues unchecked.
Yeah, we'll have to continue this when we come back from break. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interest of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. TeamUpRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Please make sure you visit our website at DGScoins.com, DGScoins.com. Make sure you sign up for a weekly newsletter. Heading into the break, we're just talking about how these treasury yields are falling and how that's supposed to signal that inflation is temporary. No, that doesn't signal that at all. It just cracks me up, but that's what they say. And Dave, you were talking about everyone on mainstream media programs, financial programs. They all think that inflation has peaked. It's just not the case. Would you like to add anything else to that before we move on?
Well, I mean, others are pointing to the 5- and 10-year break-evens. It's a bond market measure of inflation expectations that peaked in mid-May. Lumber, for example, which skyrocketed earlier in the year to levels never seen before, has fallen more than 50% the last 2 months from its all-time high. Copper, too, starting to decline. As are some other agricultural commodities. Meanwhile, China's been dumping all kinds of commodities to help bring the price of stuff over there or that they're buying down, while tightening credit and hammering big businesses at home, not the stuff that global growth is made of. Oil, of course, is at its highest in years. That's certainly a source of inflation, but also a source of pain for consumers who are going to drive and fly less as the cost of travel goes up again. And that can slow an economy more than it can ignite inflation these days. That's debatable, but it's plausible. The bond market had a bit of an inflation tantrum early this year as 10-year yields approached 1.8%, with many economists and strategists predicting a further run-up to 2% or higher. Some thought that government fiscal policy was about to become even more expansive than it already had been, coupled with historic easy money from the Fed, neither of which had any end in sight at the time, and frankly still doesn't. But even those expectations have been tamped down somewhat, as the current infrastructure proposal circulating in Washington is almost half the size of the original proposal. Hence, Wall Streeters say inflation will be transitory, again, just as the Fed has been saying all along. Mm-hmm. Melody, what do you think?
Well, here's the thing. If you use the more expansive and accurate methodologies used by the government to measure prices, we're looking at inflation is somewhere between 9 and 14%. And that's still using the old government numbers. So it was inflation is still higher. It's not 4, 5, or even 6. It's just everybody misses the point. Inflation is always with us. It goes hand in hand with the existence of the fiat dollar. And it's higher. It's a lot higher than what we're told. But if they told us what the real inflation number was, do you think that would have impacts on the various on the economy, Wall Street? Of course. So again, it's their double speak. It's what they say, not what they do. And it's just, can you bar the door? Because I don't see how prices I don't think this is the environment. It's what's making the prices rise is not a temporary transitory inflation like we experienced in 2008 in that Great Recession. This is totally different. And you know, California farmers, they're grappling with extreme drought, labor crunch, logistical snafu can add some other headaches to the list, and that's wooden pallets. The platforms used to move watermelons, tomatoes, and other bulk produce through the food supply chain have more than doubled in price, shooting up to more than $15 a piece from less than $7 a year ago. That's a lot. And this is according to Mr. Cannon Michael. He's a sixth-generation grower in California's Central Valley agriculture hub. Soaring lumber costs on top of surging e-commerce and the global movement of consumer goods turned this once mundane shipping tool into, you know, a pretty hot commodity, Dave.
Jeez, who'd have thought?
Who would have thought? He says the spike is not only leading to hoarding, but also crime.
Wow.
One tomato processor, he has gone so far as to hire a security guard to protect against theft. Michael says it's a weird time. I mean, stealing pallets? Remember copper? When copper went crazy and everybody was stealing copper out of everything they could find. Now they're stealing wooden pallets. Go figure. And what's weirder is there are a few signs of the pallet tightness easing up. Even though lumber futures plunged 44% in June, pallet prices are still rising.
Oh, Melody, this bums me out. You know, had I only known. You know, our old house, now we've been out of it for 13 years, but I bet you I had close to 30 wooden pallets in it's a pretty large basement. And the unfinished part had them all across the floor to store boxes and other things.
Mm-hmm.
Now I think, geez, 30.
How about that?
Times 7, well, that was just a measly $200 back then, but maybe probably less. But now, geez, I guess I left a lot on the table. I could have changed my investment strategy. But in any event, gold's always the better idea anyway. But government report showed this week that the pallet category and the producer price index has risen 13 straight months, jumped 31% just this year. And that matters because pallets are everywhere. We used to call them skids back in the day. 2 billion of them circulate in the U.S., and they move around invisibly to most customers in the back rooms of or in the upper shelves of the Walmarts and Home Depots and Lowe's and Costco's of the world. About 90% of them are wooden, the rest of them plastic, metal, or cardboard. But this pallet pain is hitting as the cost of farm necessities like fertilizer, fuel, and tractor parts are rising as well. Brown, who COO of Mission Produce, said that the company's seeing all kinds of inflationary things right now, but we are able to pass that on through the selling price, and we're watching it every day. So, well, there's one that it looks could be passing on to the consumer, Melody. Who'd have thunk?
Who would have thunk? Well, it seems like we talked about restaurants taking up new leases in New York, and about the big cuts in the rents, that there's a resurgence in New York. But there's also another story that's suggesting that restaurant owners can add the rising cost of food to a otherwise growing list of challenges. Independent restaurant leaders say many of their businesses will soon be forced to permanently shut down. Unless, guess what, Dave?
What?
They get more federal aid from Congress.
Ah.
Come on, yes.
Love it.
Erica Palmer, the executive director of the Independent Restaurant Coalition, says lockdowns and an ongoing labor shortage already had many local restaurant owners struggling to catch up. And for some restaurants, the soaring prices is going to be the final nail in the coffin. It could be. The price of grain was up 94% in June when compared to the same period a year ago. Beef and veal prices have surged 41%. Shortening and cooking oil prices are up 35%. You know, it's funny, Dave. We went out to eat last Friday, and we had veal, and it was probably the worst veal I ever had.
Oh.
And we asked we told the waitress about it and so forth. And she says, well, you know, she says, we can't buy the veal from who we used to buy from because of, you know, what's happening, the pandemic and so forth. And the question was, so this is what we have to serve. And look, my question was, then why are you serving it?
Yeah.
I mean, why would you, you couldn't even eat it. It didn't even taste, you know. So some of these restaurants who are having problems staying afloat, well, they still need to go back and look at their menu, their quality, their cleanliness, and everything else. You know, to me, I believe if you do those things right, you're not going to go out of business. But anyway.
Well, yeah. Well, gas prices are up 45%. And Palmer says that, you know, those rising prices mean it costs more for restaurants to transport food coming there. In fact, the inflation is the reason that the Independent Restaurant Coalition is calling on, yes, Congress, to restore the Restaurant Revitalization Fund, which shut down just yesterday after running out of money. That fund provided almost $29 billion in aid to more than 100,000 restaurants. But Palmer says many restaurant owners who qualified for aid have been left out in the cold now that the program has depleted its funds. She said over 283,000 applied for relief. By no fault of their own, they had to close for the last 15 months, and they don't have the resources to survive this.
Well, I mentioned this yesterday. We talked a little bit about it, and I see we have a little bit more information about some of the other airlines, but it was just like, here we go. Delta Airlines reported its first quarterly profit since the pandemic. Thank you, federal aid.
See, it works.
It works. Gee, oh boy, oh boy, oh boy. You know, and I think maybe you might want to pick up on that. I pretty much, they had $1.5 billion in federal aid, pandemic relief, and other one-time events. The Atlanta airline would have posted an adjusted loss of $678 million. I don't know. You know, I said yesterday, Dave, hey, give them a loan, make them pay it back. You know, take your profit and give it back. You know, isn't it good just to stay in business and break even, but to pay it back? You know, it's just.
Yeah. I mean, here's a case again where size matters, Melody. Here you got, you know, tens of thousands of restaurants who've closed permanently, and others who have barely made it through, and some of them, despite getting, in most cases, small amounts of pandemic assistance through the payroll protection program. And then you've got, you know, these mega companies like, well, Delta, for example, Southwest, who also posted a small profit in the first quarter thanks to federal relief. American Airlines says that it might do the same when it reports second quarter results at the end of this month. It helps to be big and be able to combine your resources to hire expensive connected lobbyists who know what buttons to push on Capitol Hill and elsewhere. Corporate travel even is showing signs of life, they say. Delta says it's up from 20% in the first quarter to 40% now, and expects it will hit 60% of where it was pre-pandemic by the end of September. One big weak spot remains international travel, which apparently is still deeply depressed. COVID variants as the biggest threat to that part of the industry.
Well, you know, in the beginning of the program, I mentioned that the CEO, Jeffrey Gundlach, had offered a pretty dire long-term assessment of the U.S. dollar. He thinks that the greenback is doomed. Finally, he caught up with us, Dave. He said, ultimately, the size of our deficits, both trade deficit, which has exploded post-pandemic, and the budget deficit, which is obviously completely off the charts, suggests that in the intermediate term, the dollar's going to fall pretty substantially. He says that's going to be a very important dynamic, because one of the things that helped the bond market, without any doubt, has been foreign buying, with the interest rates differentials having favored hedged U.S. bond positions for foreign bond investors. So so-called bond king made his remarks that the U.S. dollar index traded around 92.64 earlier today, Dave.
Yeah, geez. The dollar index, which, as we know, measures the world's reserve currency against a group of six others, is up 3% year to date, but still below the year's high of 93.43 that was hit on March 31st. Went into a virtual nosedive after that, until hitting its 2021 low of 89.53 towards the end of May, just in 2 months' time. Now, when it was around 89, we announced very publicly, this is Gundlach speaking, we announced very publicly that we were positive on the dollar for the near term. And that was Gundlach, whose L.A.-based investment firm has more than $135 billion in assets under management. It's a question of what your horizon is, he said. In the short term, the dynamics have been and will continue to be in place for the dollar to be marginally or moderately stronger. In the longer term, however, he added, I think the dollar is doomed. Now that is good news for gold in particular, precious metals in general, ladies and gentlemen.
Absolutely. We'll be right back. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. TeamUpRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Hey, one more time, welcome back to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen, Melody in the office taking care of client orders. This segment, call her at 1-800-375-4188, 800-375-4188. You'll be glad you did. Okay, one more time, back to the Federal Reserve, which we know includes no one, not a single person, not a elected to office by the American people. Now, on Monday, I mean, love him or not, or hate him, or somewhere in between, the Fed thumbed its nose at President Joe Biden, the man who received more than 81 million votes at the 2020 presidential election, it had more votes than Jerome Powell and his minions did. Well, last Friday, Biden issued a sweeping executive order warning federal agencies against actions that create excessive market concentration, with specific mention of bank merger activity. One business day later, on Monday, how did the Fed respond? Yes, by approving another bank merger. The Fed's actions from January 2006, in fact, through the latest data available June 30th, 2020, define the Fed as the quintessential excessive market concentrator. According to the Fed's own data, it's approved 3,576 bank mergers while denying zero merger applications since January 1, 2006. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, zero. At the end of 1999, President Bill Clinton's Wall Street-friendly administration repealed the 66-year-old Glass-Steagall Act, ushering in an era where Wall Street's trading casinos could now buy federally insured banks. Since then, the number of federally insured banks and saving institutions has literally collapsed from 10,220 to 4,978 as of the end of March this year. That's a decline of 51% in banking competition. Now, that's certainly not weighted by any kind of dollars, but you get the point. The decline in the number of overall banks fails to capture the gargantuan concentration in assets, as Pam and Russ Martins call it, at just four banking behemoths: J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, and Citibank. According to the March 31st, 2021 report from the Fed, those four banks own $9 trillion in assets of the total $22.6 trillion in assets owned by all 4,978 federally insured banks and savings association in the U.S. Put it more direct, those four banks represent just 0.08% of all banks in the country, while controlling 40% of their assets. And not to put too fine a point on it, we mention this a lot, but it's important to remember the largest bank of all, U.S. Bank, J.P. Morgan Chase, which has racked up an unprecedented five felony counts from the U.S. Department of Justice in the past 7 years for money laundering and rigging markets, owns $3.2 trillion of those assets while serving as custodian of a mind-boggling $29 trillion of other people's assets. This is just dirty. Gives me the heebies just talking about it. I mean, one doesn't have to be a rocket scientist to quickly grasp that this is the banking model from Haiti, supervised by a seriously, a number of adjectives we can use. I'll just say infatuated regulator, the Fed. In short, the Fed has effectively seized control of the nation's economic future, transferring wealth from farms, small businesses, factories, to the trading floors of Wall Street. And that's forcing the working class, in order to survive, to go deeper and deeper into debt on credit cards. That charge, by the way, an average of 16.17% interest, and that's an average, 25% on average if they had bad credit, which are conveniently owned by these same banks. Well, yesterday and today, as Melody mentioned, the House Financial Services Committee and today the Senate Banking Committee have held their quaint semi-annual chats with the Fed chair, almost like fireside chats. Although today, reportedly, I didn't see any of it, but reportedly there was some frustration and impatience leveled at Powell. Ammon Russ Martins asked, isn't it high time for these trivial, polite fireside chats to just stop, and serious discussion of congressional reform of the Fed to begin? Like starting with abruptly stripping the Fed of its power to approve bank mergers and supervise the Frankenbanks it's created. Only one word to add to that question, ladies and gentlemen. Yes. Now, here's an interesting story. I don't know if you've seen it, but it makes it seem like big tech either has something to hide or simply going all out now to protect their monopolies. Amazon and Facebook have filed petitions seeking Federal Trade Commission Chair Linda Kahn's recusal in antitrust cases involving their companies. There's consensus in the legal community that Kahn's confirmation of the FTC presents one of the clearest threats of major regulatory action in the tech sector in years, if not ever. By seeking to recuse Kahn, the companies are going after one of the biggest antitrust weapons the FTC has. And whether Kahn recuses or is recused or not, the decision could literally muck up the antitrust charges against either company. Per se, it makes sense for Facebook and Amazon to try to get Kahn removed from the suits. And by doing so, the companies may be able to cast doubt on Kahn even if she doesn't recuse. There's a bit of a catch-22. Kahn could recuse herself and leave the votes on future antitrust cases against the two companies to a group of commissioners who were evenly split on whether to file the initial charges against Facebook in the first place, 2-2. Or Kahn may not be recused, and either company could argue the whole case was tainted by her involvement. Either way, both companies argue that Kahn's past writing shows she's already made up her mind on the tech firm's liability, which the companies say should disqualify her from their cases. It's not yet clear how Kahn will handle the request or how a federal court would deal with the challenges if it came to that point. The FTC previously declined to comment on the petitions. Kahn said at her Senate confirmation hearing not too long ago that she has no financial conflicts that would be grounds for recusal under ethics laws, and that she would follow the facts of the case where they lead. Her participation in antitrust matters about the two companies appears vital to their advancement. Both sitting Republican commissioners voted against bringing the Facebook lawsuit, which was recently dismissed by a federal judge. The FTC has an opportunity to file an amended complaint this month, but would need to vote to do so. Now, assuming both Republicans vote against a new complaint, the other two Democratic commissioners were to vote for it, there would likely be a stalemate without Khan as the tiebreaker. But even if the companies are unsuccessful in getting Khan recused, they could cast the shadow over future FTC proceedings involving their businesses, at least during her reign as chair. Khan has been heralded as one of the leading thinkers in antitrust, and she published, quote, Amazon's antitrust paradox, unquote, in the Yale Law Journal while she was a law student in 2017. Yes, she's a youngster of sorts. The article argued that enforcers should apply a more expansive view of antitrust laws to digital companies like Amazon. Khan argued that traditional frameworks that largely assess whether prices go up or down for consumers could miss incentives for high-growth firms to engage in predatory pricing, among other aspects unique to their business models. Khan also worked for the Open Markets Institute. That's a political advocacy group that's been critical of several of the major tech firms' power. More recently, she worked for the House Judiciary Subcommittee on Antitrust, where she helped compile findings from the panel's investigations into Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google, into a report that made several recommendations for reforms that we talked about in this program. Amazon and Facebook argue in their petitions that Khan's past statements and work show she's already judged their cases, which should disqualify her from participation. Now, one difference between Amazon and Facebook's petitions is that Amazon is seeking to block Khan's participation in a possible future case, while Facebook is seeking to stop her from being involved in an ongoing one. The key case both Amazon and Facebook point to as precedent in their petitions is known as Cinderella Career and Finishing School versus FTC. Some of you might recall that in that case, the court determined that then-chair Paul Rand Dixon denied due process by participating in the case after making public statements that appeared to forecast his opinion. But there's an important detail in that case that could make it different from current and future cases involving both Amazon and Facebook. Because in the Cinderella case, Dixon effectively served as a judge during an internal proceeding through the FTC's administrative law process. Through that process, an administrative law judge will hear a case and make a decision, which either party can appeal up to the full commission. From there, it can be appealed to federal court. If Khan were to bring a case through the administrative law process, it would more closely resemble the Cinderella case. But if she and other commissioners decide to refile the Facebook case in federal court, particularly, she'd still be handing over the ability to rule in the outcome of the case to a federal judge. Because she wouldn't be serving as an adjudicator in that scenario, a court might just consider a different standard regarding her recusal. Even if Amazon and Facebook are unsuccessful in getting Khan's recusal from their cases, could nevertheless continue to cast doubt on litigation against them, and so be it. So even if Khan's participation doesn't trigger the FTC's rule about recusal and Khan herself doesn't choose to step away, the decision will hang over the case still. Khan can take some steps to ensure that their proceedings are beyond reproach, if that's possible, such as by having another commissioner preside over any internal case involving Facebook and being meticulous, especially meticulous, with whatever facts are brought into testimony. So, in any event, there you go. You got some really large companies trying to flex their chests. We'll see how this turns out. We'll certainly let you know. Let us know what you think about that. Should Ms. Khan recuse herself from these hearings? or should she not? Yes or no? Let us know. DaveAllen.USA@yahoo.com. We'll read your responses live on the air. Now, we don't have much time left. I was going to end with some further thoughts about inflation and low yields, but gosh, don't you think we've talked probably a little bit too much about that today? So I'm just going to end with this. More than 1.8 million unemployed Americans have turned down jobs over the course of the pandemic because of generous unemployment insurance benefits. That's according to Morning Consult's most recent poll. 29% said they turned down job offers during the pandemic because of unemployment benefits. 45% cited the generosity of the benefits as a major reason why they didn't accept the job offer. But that is, I think that's somewhat, if not fairly consistent with other reports we've heard on that. That's all going away in September, so at least the federal enhanced benefits, so that will become moot at some point. In the meantime, we are all out of time for today's program. Thank you so much for tuning in. I'll be back again next Tuesday. Melody, you'll be back tomorrow with Butch. Also be on the lookout for our weekly What a Rush of Gold and Silver blog in your email inboxes tomorrow, featuring my insights into the world of oil production. Thanks again for listening, ladies and gentlemen. Have a good evening. Please be safe out there. Bye-bye. Hey, thanks, guys.